So continuing with the CERN, of course. So you've told me about a lot of people that you've worked with over the years. Most of them brilliant, highly accomplished. Is there anything that you perceive is common to all of them? Like, is there some that you is it telltale of all these people that you work with? Is there something common to all of them that you can pinpoint? Like, oh yeah, all these successful people, they share this trait. Everybody comes in a different. From a bit.
There's a certain subset of people that I like to work with that are people like you, that are open, enthusiastic, plenty of energy. A lot of them Spanish, by the way.
Really?
Oh yeah, when we started with Boink,
Right.
almost all of the people working on Boink were Spanish. Yeah, a lot of my students were Spanish. A lot of the CERN people.
That's interesting.
Ignacio Reguero,
Yeah, I don't know him, but
no,
interesting.
Miguel Marquina
Right.
wasn't strong technically, but he got us visitors from all over the place in Spain, from
Oh, that's.
yeah, my one of the very very brightest guys, Daniel Lombrana,
I
yeah,
met him.
he was it was Miguel who had a relationship with what was the university that he was at
Castilla-La
in
Mancha.
Extremadura.
Extremadura, yeah.
Yeah, Mérida,
Yeah.
and that was through contact. There was a definite big Spanish contribution in that area. So there are a lot of, yeah, a lot of people. I've known a lot of very good Spanish
Oh
people.
wow,
Yeah,
comes.
I don't know why they have this. Well, like you, I don't know. They're hungry. They're quick. Whereas I have often been disappointed by my compatriots, who. Worked at certain times, you know, it's 5:30, you know, David is not going to be in his office, you know, this sort of thing. It's awful to, I remember when we were running the satellite, when we were running on the satellite project, we a big collaborator was the Rutherford Lab near Oxford, okay? That was so British. Now, it's true that the main collaborator there was a very good, very bright guy who was very unorthodox, but it was such a pain to go there. So we go there. I remember we were debugging this SIM. The SIM was this hardware interface between the modem and the mini computer with the tapes on. Okay, and I went with a hardware designer, a wonderful guy, a Swedish guy, and it was probably, I would guess it was like Friday morning. So Friday morning we start to set this thing up, and we need to make a correction. So the technology was wire wrap. Remember wire wrap? You've ever seen
Yeah.
anybody with you have a board.
Yeah.
This is low level integration. Okay, so
Right.
you have components and things, maybe a little processor. Okay, and it's all, and the sockets go to pins under the board, and the pins you can interconnect with wires. It's done by a computer, but if you need to make a fix.
Yes.
So I remember. So there we are, Friday. What it would have been is this: Friday, 11 by 11:30, time to go to the pub for lunch. Okay, so we get out of the pub at 2 o'clock, right? And it's virtual weekend already. And 2 o'clock in England on a Friday, and we desperately need to make this fix to test the box, and we need a wire wrap tool. He's lost his wire wrap tool, my friend. And we say to Chris, was our collaborator, Chris, we need a wire wrap tool. Where is the one? Oh yes, ah, Bernard will have one of those. Let's go and see if. So we go in, and we have to go through a long which. Hello, Bernard. How are you? First of all, he was in, which was good. And you know, it's like a negotiation for arms treaty. But do you by any chance have a wire wrap tool? Yes, what do you want to do? The guy, he had a wire wrap tool. We didn't want to lend it to him.
It's a tool.
Okay,
Oh,
so he probably did in the end. But other similar cases would be, you go on, Bernard, he's left. Yeah, back on Monday, maybe Tuesday. You know. This is infuriating. So that was the sort of thing that I didn't like. So what they had in common, yes. Now, what was most important for me, though, for me personally, was mentors. I had a
Yes.
wonderful mentor when I arrived at CERN, an Australian guy. No one's ever heard of him, called Mark Palandri. This is a guy who, he could code anything, he'd write beautiful, beautiful code. He would sit down, in those days, to write your code.
Mm-hmm.
With a, he would sit with a yellow pad,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
he would write, like Mozart, you know, comments to the right, every line. And he would write this code, pages and pages and pages, for whatever. So typically it would be assembler on some machine he was working on. Fortran, etc. Whatever. He was the guy who, everything was possible. So there were no networks, right? So he designed a network. He made a network project, okay? He got some guys. Guys would work for him that weren't in his operation. He wasn't, for most of his career, and he wasn't a group leader. He had no particular, but he was a really nice guy, and he was brilliant. He was, he would speak slowly and so on, but just brilliant. People pleasant. Loved to work for him.
Yeah, he was pleasant.
Pleasant,
yeah,
but fantastically good. Fortunately, he managed, in those days, there was enough space to do stuff like this, and he got support. So, okay, I landed at CERN in 1971, July. I'd never seen this guy. I'd been hired in a very unorthodox manner, which I mentioned to you, and I arrived, and there was nobody there. So they gave me the CDC manuals, had to learn the machine code of the CDC. Maybe I would have to program my CDC, I never did. So, and one or two other manuals. I had to wait for 2 weeks before. Because they'd said, you could work on this, this, or this. And I'd said, well, communications, that sounds interesting. I knew nothing about communication, but it sounds interesting. It did sound interesting. And so when Mark gets back from holiday, he has a Spanish wife, by the way, Rosa, a wonderful lady, they give me my project. And my project consists of 12 mini computers, which are going to be put in 12 important sites in CERN with a card reader and a line printer and a teletype and a modem, a communication line to the center. And those had one program emulating a remote job entry terminal. Do you know what that means?
Well, I understand the words separately, but...
Well, in those days, where you submitted a job...
Yeah.
Was, well, you went to the center, you gave it an operator, you gave your cards in a box an operator, and you came back and you looked in the thing on the wall, a rack, for your output, hopefully.
Right.
And this was a revolutionary idea, where instead of everybody having to come to the center, they could stay near their offices and there would be a remote input-output station.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there were 12.
Right.
Now, all this had been chosen, purchased, designed before I arrived, so I didn't have to do that, by Mark. The center had this big control data machines with the central machines, no IBM at that time in the center, and they had a remote job entry terminals with a card reader line printer. They would sell it to you, okay, and it was very expensive, and Mark hated this. It was slow, he saw them, it's slow and horrible, and he's, so he looked around, and there was no web, and he found this little company in England building a revolutionary, very fast machine that no one had ever heard of, called the Modular One, and very, very fast, completely different, of course, its own machine code, its own everything, its own operating system. It didn't have an operating system, it had a monitor. It only had 16 kilobytes of memory, right? And it was very nice design. Each unit was about the size of that, right? Maybe bigger. And so there was a CPU unit, and there was a disk. No disk. There was this memory unit, it was magnetic core memory, and there was a unit to control, I don't know, the teletiles on it. It was big, but so very expensive. And Mark found the most beautiful card reader, beautiful, smooth, wonderful card reader, and the beautiful line printer from different companies. And Mark said, they ordered all this stuff. The stuff arrives, right? And I'm just arriving too. So my job was to integrate all this stuff. And in probably half of these places, there was an operator as well who would help the poor physicists to use this thing. Because the physicists, they were just as horrible as they are now. They were impatient. Oh, it's not working. Etc. So there was a nice lady operator to calm them all down, and they could leave their cards and she would, etc. So I had this big thing, big operation to do, and I was alone. So I had to manage all of that, and I had to make sure that this thing worked. So this was a good idea. So Mark, okay, had to write. The driver for the card reader, yeah, which was not supported by the company, and for the line printer, which was not supported by the company. Now, this machine didn't have any switches or keyboard or whatever. It had, in fact, I just sent him an email the other day to figure out how he booted it. And he thought it must have been a paper tape reader, the only thing.
Yeah.
It had no switches, it had no lights, it had nothing. The only external interrupt you could give it was switch it off and on.
It's a shoebox.
Switch it off and on. It was, talk about Occam's razor.
Yeah.
Very elegant, very British, very from Cambridge. You know, and
it had no ROM to read from?
There must have been a little ROM somewhere, yeah. Yes, sure, sure. To run the tape, the paper tape. After that, you have to do it. So what we wanted was that the machine would boot out of the card. You could put some binary cards in and load the program from the cards. Mm-hmm. You got that to work. And then I remember him struggling so much to get the printer to work. And this was a brilliant programmer. And he would come to this machine and then he would go click, click. Nothing would happen. And one day, after it must have been a week for him, a huge amount of time, click, click, and one character came on the printer. He was so happy. It was that sort of environment, apart from the political problems with this, because there was also a political problem. So these things started to work. What I did was actually quite clever. It turned out they were emulating the existing remote station of the control data. Now, the control data, it had this card reader line printer, and it had a teletype.
Mm.
Now, how it worked was, you went to the original machine, and you put your cards in to the hopper of the card reader, and then you were supposed to go to the teletype and type,
yeah,
read.
Right.
Okay? And then it would read the first 12 cards. It had a buffer of 12 cards. Okay? And then you had to type something else, and it would start to communicate with the host, with the central machine, and it would print something on the teletype, and then it would read the rest of the cards, hopefully. It would read them, by the way, 12 at a time, I remember, 12, because it had a buffer, 12, it wasn't probably double buffered. Actually, I never saw the original one, I'm describing how, but they had emulated this exactly. And so we thought, oh gosh, this isn't very good, the physicists, we can't have them typing on this thing, and they get so impatient, so... So we were thinking, you know, we need to do this better. So I looked at the code of this thing. You can imagine there wasn't much code. It was all an assembler, this strange assembler.
Of course.
And Mark, by the way, being a genius, had also quickly whipped up a cross-compiler for it on the main CDC. Oh. The main CDC had a beautiful compiler, a beautiful, beautiful compiler with macros, a really powerful compiler. So whenever Mark got a new mini-computer, which was often, the first thing he would do was write a cross-compiler for it. So he wrote the cross-compiler, and I look at this code, and I saw it had been written by a most dreadful programmer. In fact, an Irish guy that we met when we went to the company to see him. No subroutine calls, all inline code. So, yeah, wonderful. Here's all this space that I can economize. So I zipped out, ripped out all that, made a subroutine call, so I saved, I don't know, a lot of space, you know, maybe a kilobyte.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. And I wrote a little emulator, a human emulator, in this code. So what would happen, you put the cards in, it read the first 12.
Exactly.
And then it sent, down the line, it sent what the guy would have typed.
Yeah.
And it, so the reply came, and it sent the next message, okay, and the rest of the cards would read. So you could walk up to it, put your cards in, and press the button, and then... But if they hadn't made that mistake, there wouldn't have been enough space to write that. Things like that. So that's how you learn.
Yeah.
You learn when you have a master mentor who writes beautiful code.
That's so true.
And you learn by reading other people's code. And same thing with this SIM, this thing to connect to the satellite. There is a raw box built by my friend, right? With a 6800 in it, not a 6809, a 6800, very limited instruction set. Well, you learn. It's very simple, but you learn.
Mm-hmm.
You have to write everything. There was there was a monitor of, I don't know, a few hundred instructions. But after that, so, you know, you have an idle loop, and you're going around checking interrupts and checking stuff. And so, I've still got the code in a box somewhere. And you can write pretty code, and it worked beautifully.
Yeah.
Because I work with the hardware guy. He would say, Ben, you know, all you have to do is put this in this register and do that, and we'll work together.
Yeah, it takes sometimes people like that to show you what's possible. It reminds me of like the 5 minute mile.
Yeah.
Like no one thought it was possible, so it took forever for it to happen. Then one day it happens. The next year, two more guys do it, and then the next one, 10, and then so on.
But I was so lucky to have a guy like that.
Well, yeah.
Now he left after less than 3 years. He left in 73. It was after just over 2 years. He left and he went to Australia, back to Australia. So lucky. If I'd finished up with a deadhead boss there, I wouldn't have done anything of this. So he introduced me to communication stuff, and he'd started another project, which I inherited with another colleague of mine when he left. A beautiful thing. Again, would you believe you had to write this and build it yourself? Okay, what was the application? The application, they're going to connect terminals, asynchronous terminals, to the control data time-sharing system. They had a primitive time-sharing system on the control data. You either bought their expensive terminals, okay, or if you wanted to connect your own terminals, ASCII terminals,
fancy.
Control data was not an ASCII machine.
Yeah,
you had to do it yourself. So, Mark Belander says, right, we're going to build a terminal concentrator, okay, and we're going to have 32 input ports for ASCII terminals, for asynchronous ASCII terminals. I think they could connect synchronous, complicated synchronous terminals of their own manufacture. And how do you connect this concentrator to the machine? On the channel. On the channel of the mainframe. Mark knew a bunch of people that are already connected. There was all sorts of channel attached equipment.
Okay. Okay.
So a channel adapter built by CERN existed and could be modified. And so it needed to be modified to go on this particular Hewlett-Packard minicomputer that Mark had chosen because it was the only one that could do microcoding.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't multiplex 32 terminals all entering characters without handling the characters super fast. Because if it did it in, I don't know, 70 milliseconds, that wasn't fast enough. He could do it in 10 with his microcode. So Mark bought the machine that would do that and coded the microcode with his own cross compiler, of course. That was beyond me. I mean, that was just. But it was an attitude like that. And he wasn't hyper, he wasn't crazy, he was just a great guy. Perfect mentor.
Yeah.
When he left, I and my German colleague, the German colleague had done the code on the CDC side, on the control data side, which would read stuff coming from the terminal concentrators and put it into the time sharing system and get the responses to come back. Okay, so he and I thought, well, you know, we can run this project. Mark has left. Instead of which, the division management, who didn't like us, had just hired a useless Dutch guy who had no function at all. I don't know how he got in. And they said, well, he can manage this project. We had one meeting with the guy, and my colleague resigned and left, sir.
Wow.
And I refused to work with him.
That meeting went well.
Well, maybe it took more than one meeting. The first meeting, we realized the guy was a loser. It was very charming, but he was completely useless.
Yeah.
He had no function.
Yeah.
And we very much resented.
Yeah. Well, it's a contrast also.
Yeah. So Hans left and became a multimillionaire. Multi-millionaire, Hans. And he started a company, and now he buys other companies and so on. I just met him recently. And I sort of went on strike and said I wouldn't work on it, but I consented to advise a replacement programmer on it. The system was basically finished by the time. And by the time Mark left. And that wasn't good at all. And so I became under a cloud, and that's why I took a sabbatical.